Hi, I'm Dr. Justin Coleman, and welcome to our ninth GP Skeptics podcast, a podcast by GPs for GPs, and in this case, a very environmentally sound podcast for GPs. I'm Dr. Justin Coleman, a Brisbane GP who rides my bike to work, and with me I have Dr. Liz Sturgis, whose environmental impact is that instead of having a big car, she has a slightly small car.
It's a very small car, Justin. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You do have to fit the kiddies into it, though.
And in Canberra, unfortunately, car is king.
That's true. A city built by politicians. And talking of environmental politics, we're delighted today to have Dr. George Crisp as our special guest. Now, George is a GP in Perth, and he's also chair of the Western Australian branch of Doctors for the Environment Australia. Good evening, George.
Good evening, Justin.
Tell us a little bit about your history of involvement in the environmental movement.
I'm not sure exactly when I really started getting interested. In fact, as far back as medical school, I can remember being quite interested in social determinants of health and hearing some work about what Michael Marmot was doing at the time. And I was always quite interested in, I suppose, the causes of ill health. I joined Doctors for the Environment over 10 years ago now, and certainly at that time, climate change had become very topical, and I sort of started getting interested in external environmental determinants of health, and then realised that, in fact, they were really big in shaping our health.
Tonight, we don't want it to be a purely Greens political podcast. It's more about what the GP might be able to do either in their surgery or for advocacy for the health of our patients.
George, I did once hear a truck driver, and he got quite cranky about the Doctors for Environment movement, and he said, I think I'll start a Truckies for Good Health movement. So some people think, you know, why are doctors in this space?
We're involved in all aspects of health, you know, whether it be person-to-person capacity that we're most used to. But of course, doctors have also been involved in public health and in health advances way beyond the confines of consulting rooms. If an environmental factor is a very important determinant of health, of course, it's the doctor's role to communicate that to our patients and to the wider community.
So, George, you've brought along a really interesting paper tonight called The Cost-Effectiveness of Environmental Approaches to Disease Prevention. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2012. Why have you chosen that paper?
When you're talking about health interventions, well, how do you rate them? You know, how do you say that they are worth doing? How do you sort of measure them against each other? Because there's innumerable things that we could spend money on. So we're quite interested in what gives you the best sort of dollar value in health interventions. You know, there are lots of preventive things that don't stack up better against therapeutic interventions. So this paper I thought was really interesting in that the researchers actually looked at reclassifying and comparing different preventive interventions, comparing environmental ones with clinical and non-clinical individual ones.
What's meant by an environmental approach?
One that's non-personal. So environment is used very broadly. It can be anything from changing sort of social circumstances. Tobacco taxes would be an environmental intervention, or it could be about sort of exercise promotion in the community, population-based things that are non-clinical. So in the paper, there are some areas that they highlight. For example, in environmental interventions, you may think about things like fluoridation of water or sanitation or tobacco taxes, versus what are really individual, i.e. person-to-person interventions. And they can happen in a clinical context, the example of pap smears, and also non-clinical. That means they're happening still person-to-person, but not in a consulting room. For example, a syringe exchange program.
The paper asked the question, if you had a bucket of money and you wanted to improve health outcomes by a certain amount, where should you spend that money? What does it find?
The authors suggest that they would expect that environmental interventions would be more cost effective, purely because if you're applying them at the population level, they tend to be less time consuming or labour intensive. They also suggest that non-clinical interventions should be more cost effective than clinical ones for much the same reasons. They looked at a database which keeps records of cost effectiveness and clinical prevention burden of disease and 1,200 or so papers. And what they found was that, indeed, environmental interventions are generally far more cost-effective than non-environmental or individual ones, but they didn't find much difference between clinical and non-clinical ones.
Could you just explain what we mean by non-clinical interventions?
Non-clinical would be activities that are still happening at the individual level. So syringe exchange was one of the ones that I mentioned, but they're not happening in a clinical context where a doctor or health professional necessarily needs to be involved. So you might expect that the clinical ones would involve more cost because doctors and health professionals cost more money.
Perhaps we are fairly effective after all when it comes to individual costs. Certainly GPs as a system is a relatively cheap thing.
The authors point out that they may not be getting all of the information here because some environmental and non-clinical activities may actually have much longer acting effects than ones that happen just in consulting rooms. So they may not be capturing all the information.
I think, George, if we have a look, though, they showed a really significant cost effectiveness for the environmental interventions by quite a big margin.
There is a very big group of environmental-based interventions that are cost-saving. So what they look at is how many dollars it takes to sort of obtain one unit of quality of life years improvement. At the best end of the scale, you actually get a cost benefit. And in that particular group, environmental interventions do far better than any of the other interventions. There are really relatively few individual interventions that are actually cost-saving. Childhood immunizations, aspirin for coronary heart disease. That's not to say that they're not cost effective, it's just that they don't come out as a cost positive. Whereas there are some environmental things that can be done relatively inexpensively across a broad population. Putting a tax on salt may have a very modest reduction in heart disease and stroke, but spread over a whole population, a very low cost intervention like that actually is very cost positive.
So is the cost the sum it costs to produce or do something minus the cost of the health burden that it produces? In this salt example, is putting a tax on salt making money for the government or is that costing money to the consumer?
In the case of taxes, they also raise revenue, which is included in the calculation. For example, tobacco taxes would be exactly the same, whereas not only are you putting a downward pressure on smoking and getting a health benefit across the community, you're also raising a revenue stream which pays for the implementation of those costs. So, of course, it changes that to a cost saving. Well, for example, if you were putting in regulations to reduce air pollution, they may not raise any money directly, but they still reduce population exposure to air pollutants and are cost saving.
It must be very difficult to include all costs. So, for example, I remember reading something where a particular intervention got people back to work and they counted that as a cost saving. But when they calculate people going back to work, they calculate a full-time employee turning up to work every single day, whereas that doesn't necessarily happen. So I guess there's a lot of assumptions made in these analyses.
There are assumptions, and some of the measures are very difficult to put exactly. When you're talking about transport interventions or energy interventions, and you're talking about the impacts of air pollution or congestion or inactivity, a lot of these things are difficult to be exact about in terms of what are the true costs in society. I think the important thing is that by standardizing them and using the same measures across all of the studies, even if there are some inaccuracies, they sort of level out. So we're using the same units to measure different studies and different interventions.
So the quality adjusted life years, which is really a way of trying to equate different levels of disability or morbidity for each year, you think that's a pretty good measure across the board?
I mean, it's a measure, and it's probably the best one that we have. It tries to take into account suboptimal health and putting a monetary value on it. Of course, you could argue that's quite arbitrary, really, and it can be very different in different cultures and different countries.
Does it suffer from the intrinsic problem that it means that a quality-adjusted life year in Australia is perhaps worth more than a quali in India, for example?
Yes, of course. And so if we're trying to work out whether an intervention is worth doing in one country or another, these sorts of things can become factors in whether they look like they're worthwhile. I mean, immunization programs is saving a life in Africa or India, the same dollar value as one in the developed world. I don't know the answer to that. It is, of course, a potential failing in the use of statistics like these.
So, George, for a clinical GP with a patient sitting in front of them, when we think about these environmental approaches, you get a very small benefit for the individual, but it's a benefit across the population. So how should GPs think of that when they're trying to communicate these benefits and risks to their patient in front of them?
I think we're very good at doing that, actually. Very good at talking to people about the risks related to smoking or drinking too much alcohol or taking folate in pregnancy. And quite often, these benefits are really very small on an individual basis, but they add up. And they make a big difference on a population basis. They don't necessarily make a huge difference on an individual basis. I mean, I think people like to think they make a really big difference. We're quite good at putting things in perspective for people.
George, are there some areas where you think we've just missed out on these hidden costs in the environment and carried on regardless?
Very much. And this is really one of the reasons that I got quite interested in cost benefits and the externalities, these hidden costs. One of the things that became really very clear when I was talking to politicians, which I've done quite a lot of in the past, about climate change or energy, is that they were cherry picking the costs that they wanted to see. If you just take the raw cost of a renewable energy versus burning a fossil fuel, it may look like the fossil fuel technology is cheaper. And what was being left out was, well, what are the health impacts of those technologies? Burning coal has been studied extensively overseas. In America, a group of scientists from Harvard in 2011 calculated, if you include the health costs and other environmental costs, and air pollution is by far and away the biggest of those costs, it actually adds double to triple the cost of the coal.
George, did they include the cost of headaches from wind farms when they were calculating those costs? Am I totally breaking up?
Unfortunately, you're not, Liz.
Guys, that was meant to be a laugh.
There's been quite a lot of work done into whether various technologies do produce adverse health effects.
Oh, George, that was a joke. It seriously was a joke.
Did you want me to answer seriously? I thought you might want me to.
No, George, no one listening to this podcast.
Oh, my God.
Well, you never quite know.
George, I now know what you think of me. Oh, my God.
No, I don't.
Sorry. What were you saying about something?
No. That's it. I'm not talking anymore.
When some costs are easily measurable, for example, public transport, it's too much money and we can't afford it. That, I think, is a fairly classic example of these hidden costs.
It is a very good example. And the upfront costs of public transport, putting in new rail lines, etc., is high. But if you actually look at the overall social benefits and the sort of health costs saved, it starts to look very different. Car use also involves much more inactivity, congestion, which adds a lot of time loss, the air pollution costs. So if you start to add all those costs in, public transport actually starts to become much more cost saving. To take that further, if you look at more active forms of transport, for example, cycling, there was a meta-analysis done a couple of years ago that looked at 20 studies of cyclists in terms of what economic impacts they had. And the average was that for every dollar that was spent on cycling infrastructure and promoting cycling, there was a $13 return captured through reduced pollution, reduced health impacts, and also greater economic activity along cycle routes. It's interesting that if you look at where people cycle, they actually spend money along the way, and the money that they save by not spending on petrol, they tend to reinvest in local communities.
Is that mainly in cafes, George? I see a lot of men in Lycra drinking their coffees in Canberra.
Before you answer that, George, let me just ask this parallel question. If you had one GP who cycled to work and another GP who drove a small car, who do you think's the better person? Just as a neutral question.
So the first part of that question, so I think that whilst they do spend money on coffee in the coffee shops, they also tend to activate those streets, improve activity, so you get more money spent and more economic activity along cycle routes. It's easy for people to hop a bicycle and nip into a shop and get something on their way to work. It's not easy to park, and other people don't walk so much when there's a lot of traffic around. And interestingly, if you take cars off streets and you get more pedestrians and cyclists, you actually reduce crime rates. In terms of who's a better person, well, clearly the cyclist is going to be a better person. There's no question about that.
If the crime rate in Canberra starts rising, we know who to call.
That's right. Yes.
Do they build in the cost to people's eyesight of Lycra, though? That's what I want to know.
Yes, Lycra is actually made of oil, made by a company owned by the oil barons, the Koch brothers in America. So I don't have Lycra for that reason.
Justin, do you wear Lycra?
There is that audio problem too, the annoying clip-clop of my little shoes as I clop across the pavement. I guess that's also a bit of...
You are a Lycra. Are you a Lycra person, Justin?
Much to my wife's annoyance, tend to wear last night's T-shirt on my cycle because why should I change and get two things sweaty? But I do actually own a full set of Lycras.
I'm thinking of a nice photo to go on the web for this one, Justin.
I will put a picture up. Not.
Where do we go from there, really? George, just to play devil's advocate a little bit more, some people might see this as a bit of a nanny state intervention and controlling people and the way they go about their daily life. What would you have to say to that argument?
It's obviously a very political and contrived argument. If you look at the history of public health, in fact, the history of our progress over the last 200 years, I mean, one of the most striking things is how long we live and how much healthier we live now. That's happened just within a few generations. And you have to say, well, why did it happen? What were the things that changed our health so much? And it's not the hospitals and the high-tech interventions that happened there. The single biggest factor was probably the chlorination of water. If you clean up your water supply, you make a dramatic improvement to the health of communities, particularly infant and childhood mortality, dropped enormously within a very short space of time. If you look at other interventions that have been the most effective ones, they're just about all operating at a population level. Food hygiene and air pollution and air quality. We don't basically say, oh, they shouldn't have sanitized the water and cleaned up the air. It's a nanny state intervention. We wouldn't want to go back to the sort of health outcomes that we had. And the same is true, of course, of acting on climate change and still acting on air pollution. Try and sort of dismiss those as being bad because they're state initiated is crazy.
Throughout the 20th century, for every year, life expectancy gained in first world countries like Australia was a quarter of a year. So in other words, between 1900 and 2000, you had a 25-year gain in life expectancy. I mean, that's just extraordinary.
It's amazing. It really is so remarkable. I don't think there's ever been anything like that in human history.
Think of your 80-year-old patients who are very fit and well. In general, you look through their life history and they won't have had lots of medications over their life. They won't have had a heap of hospital admissions. So it's more the stuff that's happened to them outside the individual doctor's surgery, if you include things like vaccines as part of that environmental thing.
Yes, it's really the determinants of health that have improved, largely happening, with the exception of things like immunization, outside of the health service, happening at population level. And those are the things that have kept people well and kept people away from doctors.
There's a really beautiful quote from a medical student, actually, Victoria Smith, that came out in the MJA in 2015. And she wrote a beautiful reflection that won the Nossal Global Health Prize. Good health is not made in hospitals. Good health is made by the food we eat, the water we drink, by feeling safe, secure, and loved and connected. It's the roof over our heads, our sense of purpose in the world.
I think on that quote, it is a fine time to finish our segment with you. Thank you, George Crisp. You've been a revelation. If people want to join Doctors for the Environment Australia, we'll have the link to them on our website. Thanks very much, George.
Thank you, Liz and Justin.
Thanks, George. It's been great speaking with you, and you've almost inspired me to get a bike, but perhaps without the Lycra. And now it's time for... Liz's Magic Marketing.
I always start grooving to that music. Now, Liz, I think you're up to your final word of the Mindspace recommendations. Is that right?
I think we are actually up to the last part of that framework. Can you remember all of them, Justin? Or
I remember the last one starts with E. That's as far as my memory goes.
So E actually stands for ego. So
Can I mention the Skyhook song again? Ego's not a dirty word. I used to be a huge Shirley Strawn fan. Wish I was Shirl.
Ego today is not a dirty word. What the framework is talking about there is that we make decisions in ways that make us feel good about ourselves. So even as doctors, when we're prescribing, we tend to have a tendency to want to do things that make us feel good. Katrina Anderson, who's one of the fantastic lecturers at the ANU Medical School and all around fantastic GP educator, uses a really great Lunig cartoon in her teaching on depression. And in this cartoon, the doctor is explaining to the patient about how he wants to prescribe a medication that will give the patient a sense of well-being and overall health and glow. And the end shows the doctor leaning back in the chair, feeling really fantastic that he's prescribed this medication. That sums up, I guess, that ego concept pretty well.
I can understand as a GP that a lot of consultations, you do want to walk out of the consultation feeling good yourself. And I think some of the things we do are aimed at getting that closure sometimes so we feel okay about it.
And I think that's okay. And I think it's a natural human way to be. But being aware of that fact and the impact that might be having on your prescribing habits is really important. And we all know that feeling of a consultation where you've had to say no to a patient or not provide what they particularly thought they needed. And it does leave you with a bit of a feeling of blur at the end of it. And that's definitely something I noticed new registrars often talk about and need to work through, that feeling after a consultation that doesn't go so well.
Most of my early shoots for registrars, just starting off, the ones after we do the boring old stuff like the PBS and how to use the computer, are things like consultations where you're not really sure what's going on by the end of it, the feeling of uncertainty. A lot of those are about how to finish off things so that you feel reasonable about it. And I guess that is an ego thing. You get better at it as you get more experience because you realize more proportions of your consultations are like that than you ever thought possible when you studied medical school.
Absolutely. We're always looking for certainty when we first start out, but in GP land, it's often not the case.
So, Liz, what traps do you think we can fall into by stoking our ego at the end of the consultation? Is it just prescribing too much or prescribing where we shouldn't?
I guess sometimes it comes back to that feeling like you've got to do something, and the real art of general practice is the art of doing nothing. So you can fall into a trap with your prescribing of feeling that you're doing the right thing rather than maybe sitting back and using alternative management.
Could I just check whether you want that as a bumper sticker or a t-shirt? General practice is the art of doing nothing. Liz Sturgis, 2017.
What is that quote? It's the mastery of artful nothing something. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I don't know that would fit on the t-shirt all that well, Liz. Perhaps you're looking at commie therapy, cat-like observation and masterful inactivity.
That's it.
The one I learned when I was
masterful
a med student.
Masterful inactivity, which sounds much better than the art of doing nothing.
I thought your quote there was the art of having a fairly bad quote on your t-shirt. But let's... Perhaps it's time to move. Oh, Liz, is that the last mind space? What are we thinking of doing next week?
Well, we thought we might move on to looking at places to get great information as a GP. And I think you came up with a really great name for the segment.
That would be Liz's special sauce.
Sauce.
Spelt O-U-R-S-E or A-U-C-E. I haven't decided yet.
That's either going to be a cooking segment.
My kitchen rules the pot.
Fantastic.
While we leave that thought simmering away there, I think it's time for our next segment, and that would be Justin's Factoids. What happened to that music?
We are in a rush today. I have places to be, so I appreciate that music just going super fast.
Ooh, at twice the speed. Let's try that again. The factoid today is not all that fast. Screening in the community. And Liz, you mentioned you're doing some screening this morning, which you can talk about in a moment. But it did remind me that in Tennant Creek, when I was a junior registrar, that my senior doctor suggested at one day we went out into the community and started doing blood pressure and blood sugars. And even at that young age, when I wasn't as skeptical as I am now, I did wonder what benefit we were going to get trolling people on the street, grabbing their arm and throwing a blood pressure cuff around it. It's not as if people didn't want that to happen. There wasn't much going on in Tennant Creek.
No, because otherwise that would be assault, Justin.
I remember thinking at the end of the day, I may as well just honestly have been sitting in my surgery doing the same thing to the people who walked in. What were you doing this morning, Liz?
I was supervising medical students doing blood pressures at a local festival, which I signed up for supervision thinking, oh yeah, that sounds like a good thing to do. And I didn't give it much thought, I have to say, I just rocked up. And when the students first said, so what is a good blood pressure number? And when you say, well, it depends. It doesn't fill the students with a whole lot of confidence.
Why did we stuck with the dud GP?
That's right. Who is this chick? Has someone checked her ID? But really, you know, if the person who's being screened has diabetes, if they're a smoker, what's their cholesterol? It becomes really difficult to give them good holistic advice when you're used to doing that as a GP in your room.
all those nasty studies that made it all so complex. Whatever happened to the good old days? If it was above 160, it was bad, and if it was below 160, it was fine. Bring them back, I say.
It would make things a lot easier. And you know, how low is too low? And in that setting, I even found it quite hard to ask a person that came along for screen like their age or something like that. You know, it's a very public forum. Yeah, it was tricky, trickier than I thought it was going to be.
Maybe do you just go with a low cutoff margin, and for anyone above that cutoff margin, say, look, pop in and see your GP and they can take a proper history.
That's where I ended up with. It becomes really difficult. I guess with those kind of community outreach, what you're trying to do is get to people that may not be accessing medical care. But it seems like a really no-brainer. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to go and help people. It's much trickier than first would seem.
It almost smacks of getting customers through the door in a way, which to me I find a little bit odd. And you do wonder, are there really all these people out there who never go and see their GP but will walk into a community screening? I'm not convinced. I think most of the people who go to the community screening are probably the ones who eventually would turn up to their GP over the next year or so anyway.
And now for our final segment of this evening. What would Justin do? Just to remind everyone, I don't ever give you a clue about what we're going to talk about. I'll give you a choice. Do you want depression or chronic back pain?
I will go depression. Thank you very much.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Depression for $500. So the patient sitting in front of you, you've worked out they've got mild to moderate depression. You've worked through some options and they've said, no, don't feel like doing that. No, not able to do that, da 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 da. And there's a feeling inside you like you really want to prescribe a medication.
So that would be my ego chipping in, as you've just pointed out previously.
Maybe the ego. You know, you've assessed this person. They're not someone that you think would benefit from an antidepressant. But there's that feeling inside you like you're a bit desperate. You need a medication of desperation. How do you resist that? Or do you resist that for a start, I suppose?
Back in the day, there used to be an actual placebo. From memory, it was something like a verapamil wafer or a dissolvable tablet or something, which they deliberately made with no medication in it. And you used to be able to prescribe that as a placebo.
What? When was that?
Back in the bad old days.
Oh, my
when you could get away with that sort of stuff. I thought it was brilliant. Actually, to tell you the truth, I never used it, but I think it was being phased out as I came through.
Sure. That's what you're saying now. You never use it.
So I should have chosen back pain because we've had that study recently showing that paracetamol is virtually a placebo. So that would have been a very easy answer, wouldn't it? But I can't think of any great placebo for depression. There is a concept which was in vogue for a little bit there of activity scripts, where you write out as if it were a prescription. Perhaps it was the days of the paper script pads, do 30 minutes walking, or I guess you could tell them to take a paracetamol tablet, but make sure the paracetamol tablet is 2 kilometres from where you're sitting in your bathroom, and then you have to go and get it and eat it and then come back again.
The life scripts, I think they were called. And when I last looked at those online, they're taken down offline now, saying that the evidence now shows they're not the thing.
Okay, so it was an evidence-based decision to stop them, was it? Because I always thought it was a cute idea, if nothing else.
If you look up life scripts now online, it says all life scripts resources have been withdrawn from circulation as they're no longer consistent with the current evidence and guidelines endorsed by NH and MRC. Right. This might be one, what would Justin do, where you actually got something wrong. I have the proof.
Yeah, pretty much I have no answer and failed the impossible to fail segment for the first time.
Do you resist that feeling to prescribe if you know the medication's not really going to make a difference?
I do resist and I don't prescribe, and I'm a grumpy old man who just doesn't give scripts when they're unnecessary.
There you go. You redeemed yourself.
Given all three adjectives, grumpy, old and man, don't apply to you, how about yourself, Liz? Would you ever do a script where you thought it wasn't really indicated?
I'm sure there are times I've given scripts where I've given into that feeling of desperation of, oh, I just have to do something. And I'm sure it happens more before lunch. I get very hangry before lunch and I don't consult at my best. But it is something, as you get more experience, you get better at trying to work out what the patient is really wanting treated and seeing if you can help them with that even without prescribing them a medication.
Liz, thanks very much for that tonight, and thank you for the last of the Mindspace framework, and we look forward to Liz's special sauce next week. Thanks to George for coming on the podcast. We will see you next time around.
Looking forward to it.
Bye, Liz.
Bye.